Welcome to your custom deep dive. We're diving into the world of quantum computing today. And wow, judging by this stack of research you've sent over, you're ready to go deep.
It's clear that you want to understand the why behind the what. So let's go beyond the hype and really uncover what makes quantum computing so revolutionary.
All right, sounds good. So I keep seeing this word qubit everywhere I turn in these articles. Is that like the starting point for wrapping my head around all this quantum stuff?
Absolutely. The qubit is the basic unit of information in quantum computing.
Okay, like the bit is for regular computers, right?
Exactly. And here's where it gets interesting. Unlike a bit, which has to be either a zero or a one, a qubit can actually be both zero and one at the same time.
Hold on, wait. How is that even possible? That's like saying a light switch can be both on and off at the same time.
That's the beauty of quantum mechanics. It's not bound by the same rules as the macroscopic world. Think of it like, a coin spinning in the air before it lands.
Okay.
It's not heads or tails yet, right? It's in this uncertain state where both possibilities exist at once. That's basically superposition.
So it's not that we just don't know if it's zero or one yet. It's really both. My brain hurts.
It's a strange new world. And it's this both at once potential that makes quantum computing so powerful.
Okay, but if we don't even know if a qubit is a zero or a one until it lands, how can we use them to actually compute anything?
That's a great question. The thing is, we don't actually need to know the exact state of each individual qubit to get useful information out. We manipulate groups of these qubits while they're still in this fuzzy superposition state.
And so we're harnessing the power of maybe, basically.
Exactly. It's like conducting an orchestra where the instruments are playing all the notes at once, but somehow it still makes a melody.
Wow. Okay. So I came across something called the no cloning theorem in one of these papers, Steen's quantumcomputing.pdf. It suddenly felt less like science and more like a spy novel. What is the deal with this no cloning business?
It does have a certain intrigue to it, but the no cloning theorem is a fundamental principle of quantum mechanics.
Like a law of nature in the quantum world.
Exactly. And what it says is, you can't just create a perfect copy of an unknown quantum state.
Oh, hold on. So you're saying we can't just copy and paste quantum information?
You got it. And that has huge implications for how we think about quantum computing and quantum communication.
Okay, so if we can't copy a qubit, then how do we even process information, let alone send it anywhere?
We have to completely change our thinking. Mm-hmm. In classical computing, we copy bits all the time. We make copies to send them across networks. We make copies to back them up. But with qubits, we can't do that. We have to use this other amazing phenomenon called entanglement.
Entanglement, right. I've heard of that. Isn't that where two particles are somehow linked, even if they're miles apart?
Exactly. Imagine two of those spinning coins we talked about, but this time they're linked. If one lands on heads, you instantly know the other one will land on tails, no matter how far apart they are.
How? That's crazy.
It's entanglement. It's like they have this secret connection that transcends space itself.
Okay, I am trying to imagine these two linked coins, but my brain is like short-circuiting. How does this help us actually send information with qubits if we can't copy them?
So imagine you and I each have one of these linked coins, one half of an entangled pair of qubits. Let's say I want to send you two bits of information. It could be 00, 01, 10, or 11. I can actually encode that information into the overall state of our two entangled qubits.
Okay, I'm following so far.
Now, by manipulating my qubit in a specific way, I can change the overall entangled state.
Even though my qubit is miles away.
Exactly. Then all you have to do is measure your qubit and you'll be able to decode those two bits of information that I sent.
Wait, so by messing with your coin, you instantly change mine and that sends me a whole message.
It's not quite instant, but it is incredibly fast. That's the power of entanglement. It allows us to do something called dense coding, where we can send two bits of information using just one qubit.
Okay, my mind is officially blown. So we've got these incredible qubits, superposition, entanglement, dense coding, but how do we actually control and manipulate these qubits to do anything useful, to actually build a quantum computer?
That's where quantum gates come in. They're how we control and manipulate these qubits.
Quantum gates, yeah. Like logic gates from classical computing.
Exactly. Just like logic gates are the building blocks of circuits in classical computing, quantum gates are what we use to manipulate qubits and their entangled states.
Okay, so instead of just mores and ones, these quantum gates are manipulating those fuzzy superpositions and entangled states. That sounds really complex.
It is complex, but it's also incredibly elegant. Unlike classical computing, where you need a ton of different logic gates, in quantum computing, we can actually achieve a huge range of operations with just a small set of universal quantum gates.
Universal quantum gates. So it's like having a universal remote that can control any device.
That's a good way to think about it. It's like having a set of master keys that can unlock any door.
I like it. But even with these master keys, actually building a quantum computer, that still seems incredibly hard.
You're not wrong. It's like trying to build a watch, but on the scale of atoms.
And with those atoms constantly moving and jiggling around.
Exactly. Quantum computers are extremely sensitive to any kind of external disturbance. Even the slightest interaction with the environment can mess up those delicate quantum states.
And that leads to errors in the computations, right?
Right. We call this decoherence. It's one of the biggest challenges we face in quantum computing.
Decoherence. So it's like the environment is constantly trying to measure our qubits, forcing them to be either a zero or a one, and messing up our superpositions.
You got it. And the more qubits you have and the longer the computations run, the harder it becomes to shield them from this
So
decoherence.
it's like the more we try to scale up, the harder it gets to keep everything in that fragile quantum state.
Exactly. Which is why researchers are developing all sorts of clever ways to build these quantum computers. Our sources mention a few different approaches, like ion traps, NMR, even these high-Q optical cavities.
So these are like the different strategies for actually building the hardware.
You got it. Each with their own pros and cons.
Okay. Let's start with ion traps. I saw Steen describe them in his paper, but to be honest, it went a little over my head.
Sure. Imagine we use lasers to trap individual atoms, ions to be precise, and suspend them in a vacuum. These ions become our qubits. And then by controlling the lasers very carefully, we can manipulate the energy levels of those ions.
So it's like we're levitating atoms with lasers and using their energy levels to represent zeros and ones and even superpositions.
Exactly. It's like a high-tech juggling act, but with atoms instead of juggling balls.
That's wild. But if we're trapping single atoms, how do we get those atoms to actually compute something?
Remember those quantum gates we talked about? We
Well,
can actually use lasers to apply those gates to the ions, to individual ions, or even to groups of ions simultaneously. So we're basically orchestrating interactions between these trapped ions to perform computations.
it sounds incredibly precise.
It is, and that's one of the main advantages of ion traps. We can control individual qubits with incredible accuracy.
But what are the downsides? There's always a catch, right?
Well, one of the biggest challenges with ion traps is scalability.
Scalability. Meaning what?
Meaning, how do we go from trapping a few ions to trapping millions or even billions of them, which is what we'd need for a really powerful quantum computer? It's not easy to control that many ions at once.
Right, it's like trying to herd cats, but on an atomic scale.
Yeah, something like that. So that's one of the big engineering challenges with ion traps. Now, NMR, on the other hand, that's a whole different approach.
NMR, right. Nuclear magnetic resonance. I remember that from chemistry class.
It's the same principle, but instead of giant machines imaging your knee, we're using it to manipulate the spins of atomic nuclei within molecules.
The spin. So we're not talking about the atoms themselves, but something even smaller inside the atoms.
Exactly. And here's the really clever part. We don't just use one molecule. We use a whole bunch of them, all dissolved in a liquid.
A bunch. Like,
Yeah.
how many are we talking?
Trillions. It's like having trillions of tiny quantum computers all working on the problem at the same time.
Trillions. It's a lot.
Ooh-ah.
So it's like parallel processing, but on a massive scale.
Exactly. And that massive parallelism is one of the big advantages of NMR.
So what's the catch? It can't all be good, right?
Well, one of the big challenges with NMR is actually reading out the results from all those trillions of tiny quantum computers. It's like trying to have a conversation in a really noisy room. The signal-to-noise ratio is pretty low.
Because there's so much going on at once.
Exactly.
So ion traps, they're like the precise but hard to scale up option. And NMR is like having a huge crowd of tiny computers
Yeah.
all shouting the answer at once. What about these high-Q optical cavities? They sound like something straight out of Star Trek.
They do, don't they? Imagine a tiny mirror chamber, but it's so reflective that light can bounce back and forth inside millions of times before it actually escapes. That's a high-Q optical cavity.
Okay, I'm trying to picture that, and we're trapping atoms inside these like echo chambers of light.
Yeah, exactly. And the reason we do that is because that really intense light field inside the cavity lets us control the atoms we trap inside, the atoms that we're using as our qubits, with incredible precision.
So it's almost like we're using light itself as a tool to manipulate the quantum states.
Yeah, you could say that. And one of the most exciting possibilities with these cavities is that they could be the key to connecting different quantum processors together. Imagine if we could use light to teleport quantum information from one ion trap to another, even if they're miles apart.
Like quantum teleportation? Are you serious? How would that even work?
It's a real thing. But let's maybe save that for another deep dive. For now, let's get back to what these quantum computers can actually do. You mentioned Shor's algorithm earlier, and it's a big one.
Right, Shor's algorithm. From what I understand, it's all about factoring large numbers, which sounds kind of boring, honestly.
It might sound boring, but it has huge EE implications. You see, right now, a lot of our digital security, like everything from online banking to, what, let's just say, sensitive information, relies on the fact that it takes classical computers a really, really long time to factor large numbers.
So you're saying that our entire digital world is built on the assumption that some math problems are just too hard for computers to solve quickly?
In a nutshell, yes. But a quantum computer running Shor's algorithm could potentially crack those codes in a fraction of the time.
Wait, seriously? So instead of taking, like, millions of years to break an encryption key, a quantum computer can do it in, what, days? Hours?
Potentially, yeah. It's a serious concern, and it's why governments and cybersecurity experts are paying very close attention to this field. But Shor's algorithm is about more than just breaking codes. It shows us just how fundamentally different and more powerful quantum computers can be when it comes to solving certain types of problems.
Okay, so it's not just that they're faster. They're tackling these problems in a whole new way.
Yeah.
Our sources get into some pretty intense details about this. Quantum parallelism, entanglement, interference. Should I be worried?
Not at all. The main takeaway is this. Imagine you're trying to find a specific grain of sand on a beach. A classical computer has to look at each grain one by one until it finds the right one, right? But a quantum computer, using superposition, can essentially look at all the grains simultaneously. That's quantum parallelism.
So it's like having an army of, like, sand sifters all working at the same time, each one checking a different grain.
Exactly. But then the question becomes, how do we pick out that one special grain, the right answer, from all the others? That's where entanglement and interference come in. By cleverly using these quantum properties, we can essentially amplify the signal of the correct answer and cancel out all the noise from the wrong ones.
So it's sifting through all those possibilities and discarding the wrong ones until only the right answer remains. Okay, well, my mind is officially blown again, but we've talked about how fragile these qubits are, right? About decoherence and all that. So even if we manage to build these powerful quantum computers, how do we make sure they're not, like, constantly making mistakes? I saw something about quantum error correction. Is that the answer?
That's the million-dollar question. Remember that analogy of trying to build a house of cards on a vibrating table? Well, quantum error correction is kind of like learning to build that house of cards so that it's completely immune to the vibrations. It's about making our quantum information more resilient to errors.
Okay, but how do we actually do that? How do we error correct a quantum computer?
It's incredibly complex, but essentially, it involves spreading out the quantum information across multiple physical qubits. It's like sending a message over a really noisy channel. You repeat yourself to make sure the message gets through, right? Quantum error correction is similar, but it's like repeating yourself in a really, really clever way.
So we're building in these safeguards, these backup systems at the quantum level.
Exactly. And while it's a huge challenge, it's essential if we want to build quantum computers that are actually reliable and can tackle real-world problems.
So after going on this deep dive, I have to ask, is quantum computing the real deal? Is it actually the future? Or is it mostly hype?
It's still early days, but the progress we're making is incredible. We're not all going to have quantum computers on our desks next year, but the potential is huge. It really feels like we're on the edge of a whole new technological era.
An era where we can solve problems that we once thought were impossible. But really, if you think, if we can crack these challenges, what else might be possible? What other impossibilities are just waiting for the right technology to come along? And that's something for you to think about. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive, and we'll see you next time.